Nuclear protest victories. They seem few and far between, what with the insane levels of funding the nuclear industry has to rebut, sink, deny, or demolish the talking points of those who oppose them. But every so often, we win one. Thus, it is great news when we heard about a recent critical hearing before the Los Angeles Water Board regarding the cleanup of Boeing's Santa Susana Field Lab site, which sits at the base of the hills only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles. And, as one dedicated parent and activist tells us about a recent critical hearing before the LA Water Board,
"We all started advocating to the Water Board that this was wrong. The water permit needed to be tighter. They needed to be doing groundwater studies. They needed to be doing stronger limitations and using better technology. And for the first time ever, the board listened to us and they granted a stronger permit."
Well, when Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab, a mother who has been fighting for cleanup of that radiologically contaminated site for years, gets a chance to share some good news for a change, we learn that sometimes we actually do get to make progress against that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we hear from Melissa Bumstead, founder and co-director of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. She shares about their recent success in holding Boeing's feet to the fire to clean up the radioactive and toxic mess that was made at their site starting as far back as the 1950s. And we take a deeper look at the meaning of the doomsday clock setting by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, guided by the words of veteran peace activist Alice Slater. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Alistair Burnett from ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, with our monthly update directly from ICANN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, and more honest nuclear information than most people have any bandwidth to address just now. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 4th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out here in the U.S., where in South Carolina, state-owned power company Santee Cooper said it is looking for proposals from companies interested in finishing construction on two nuclear reactors at a site near Columbia, South Carolina, known as V.C. Summer. There is one active nuclear reactor at V.C. Summer already, but the story of the rest of that site is a chronicle of failure. Santee Cooper and a utility known as South Carolina Electric and Gas in 2017 abandoned their project to build two more reactors there amid financial difficulties that included Westinghouse's bankruptcy filing. Customers were left on the hook for billions in costs without ever getting the power that was initially planned. Executives involved in the project pleaded guilty to fraud, and the companies involved settled charges with the Securities Exchange Commission. A Wikipedia page associated with the site calls it Nukegate. At the time, Public Service Commission Chairman Swain Whitfield said The reactor's cancellation after $9 billion of investment, more than the state's annual budget, is going to shatter lives, hopes, and dreams in South Carolina. The VC Summer Project started out as a $10 billion effort, but by the time of its being abandoned in 2017, the owners projected that completing it would cost over $20 billion, and the local newspaper, the Post and Courier, estimated that it could be as much as $25 billion. And remember, that's money in terms of 8 years ago. But now, Santee Cooper says it is considering reviving the project because power demand is rising across the country, fueled by the needs of AI-driven data centers. Microsoft, Amazon, and Google have partnered or made investments with startup nuclear companies to build the non-existent, not yet design-approved, small modular nuclear reactors. Meanwhile, other left-for-dead nuclear projects are being revived to, at least in theory, power data centers, including Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, which suffered a meltdown in 1979. Now, South Carolina state government officials have already investigated the site and found that it is in what they are considering to be decent condition, aside from some, quote, surface rust. With enough tech dollars behind it, even the rusty remains of Nukegate could possibly be revived. Here in Southern California, Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab joined forces with other environmental groups to push for a stronger permit that regulates how much pollution from the Santa Susana Field Lab can enter local watersheds. Boeing, the company that owns the site and is responsible for the cleanup, has already been fined more than $1 million for past violations by allowing the lab's lead, arsenic, mercury, radionuclides, and perchlorate and more to contaminate the surrounding waterways. Yet, Boeing was about to get a weaker permit, allowing them to release even more pollution offline. We'll have much more about this in a few moments with our featured interview with Melissa Bumstead, the founder and co-chair of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We'll also link to this source article, which has a lot of really good information in it. In Navajo Nation in the Southwest United States, trucks will once again carry uranium ore from the Pinyon Plain Mine near the Grand Canyon to the White Mesa Mill in southern Utah. This after Navajo Nation announced a new agreement with Energy Fuels, establishing conditions for hauling this ore across the Navajo Reservation. Energy Fuels began mining operations at Pinyon Plain in January of 2024 against the opposition of local tribes and conservation advocates. When the company began transporting ore across the reservation in late July 2024 without advance notice, Navajo Nation President Bu Nygren issued an executive order temporarily prohibiting any further ore shipments without an agreement between the tribe and the company. And now they've got one. After 6 months of negotiations, an agreement is in place. Uranium ore hauling will resume before the end of February. Around 3 to 5 truckloads of ore will cross Navajo Nation daily at first, and the volume is expected to rise to about 12 shipments per day for the remaining life of the mine, which is estimated to be anywhere between 2 and 6 years. The agreement includes a $1.2 million one-time payment from Energy Fuels to Navajo Nation and ongoing payments at a rate of 50 cents per pound of processed uranium produced at White Mesa. Those in charge admit that there is no uranium-specific emergency plan in existence for Navajo Nation, as the shipments are about to go across their land. And there is still tremendous opposition to this deal. When we learn more from our contacts in Navajo Nation, we'll have it on the show. In a separate story, a group of Diné people marched to the Navajo Nation Council Chambers in Window Rock on Monday, February 2nd, to commemorate the National Day of Remembrance for Downwinders and to urge their tribal leaders to push the U.S. Congress to reauthorize the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, also known as RECA. It provides a program that compensates individuals who become ill because of exposure to radiation from the United States development and testing of nuclear weapons. But because of congressional inaction, the program expired last summer, That means no new claims can be filed, and only claims postmarked before June 10, 2024 will be considered. We're still fighting for RICA up in Washington, according to Kathleen Sosi, a two-time cancer survivor who has advocated for RICA for decades and serves on the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee. Maggie Billiman, founder of the Sawmill Diné Warriors, spoke in front of the Navajo Nation Council chambers on Monday, saying, "The White House needs to know we're human as much as they are." And U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, a Democrat from Arizona, said, "For decades, Arizonans living near uranium mining sites and nuclear testing zones have been exposed to dangerous levels of radiation, causing people to suffer from serious health conditions. We owe it to them and to all those impacted across the country to right this wrong and get them the support they deserve." You know, Trump could launch a nuclear first strike all on his own, but there is a bill that could stop him. Here's this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter.
President Trump now has sole authority to launch the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The president can unilaterally make a launch decision and implement it directly without consulting senior leaders. He does not need to get approval from or even inform the Secretary of Defense or Congress. Let that sink in. Not that anyone should ever launch nuclear weapons, whether they are allowed to or not, and no matter who approves it, under what circumstances would there be any point in doing so? If it's in retaliation, it's already too late. If it's a first strike, our own extinction is 15 minutes away. Current U.S. nuclear launch policy is terrifying, dangerous, and unconstitutional. So wrote Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey and Congressman Ted Lieu of California, both Democrats, who together are reintroducing their bill, the Restricting First Use of Nuclear Weapons Act, to ensure that no president can start a nuclear war without congressional approval. Given the hateful rhetoric and destructive decision-making already coming out of the Trump White House, passing this legislation has never been more imperative. As the statement from Markey and Lieu reads, "We must put guardrails on presidential authority to start nuclear war. We must never again entrust the fate of the world to just one fallible human." The bill, if enacted, would restrict the first use strike of nuclear weapons. The Constitution already gives Congress the sole power to declare war. Why then does the U.S. president have the sole power to start what would be the most deadly and final war of all? As the Markey-Lieu bill states, the framers of the Constitution understood that the monumental decision to go to war, which can result in massive death and the destruction of civilized society, must be made by the representatives of the people and not by a single person. Clearly, a first-use nuclear strike carried out by the United States would constitute the ultimate act of war, and a first-use nuclear strike conducted absent a declaration of war by Congress would violate the Constitution. And yet, as the law currently stands, a U.S. president can launch a first strike of nuclear weapons in, as it were, a sacred vacuum where only he, and unfortunately it is still a he, is making that choice. U.S. nuclear launch policy may indeed be terrifying, dangerous, and unconstitutional, but any nuclear launch policy is terrifying and dangerous, even if it is constitutional. Despite the good intentions of this bill, to make us just a tiny bit safer and reduce the likelihood of a nuclear launch, it keeps us within a mindset that we could launch nuclear weapons, and that under certain circumstances, this might actually be a good idea. Until we accept that using nuclear weapons under any circumstances would be an act of omnicide, gaining nothing for either side while resulting in a global catastrophe beyond imagining, we will always be one bad decision away from such an outcome, whether caused by a single mad despot or with the approval of a compliant cabinet and Congress. And lest we doubt that Congress might go along with such a heinous and ultimately suicidal act, we only have to take note of the slavish and sycophantic behavior toward Trump that a majority of the Republicans elected to Congress are now demonstrating to know this could be a real possibility. This bill, if passed, will throw up at least one important safeguard, but it doesn't remove the nuclear sword of Damocles still hanging over all of us. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
Thank you, Linda. And now...
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We have a triple header of numbnutsery this week to cite because, hey, it's just that kind of a world. Courtesy The Onion. Based on the mounting scientific evidence showing the risks of using such explosive devices as nuclear bombs, outgoing U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory in which he recommended adding cancer warning labels to all nuclear bombs. He said, "Nuclear bombs can cause cancer anywhere they are detonated, yet far too few Americans understand the dangers of standing in a nuclear blast zone for even a few minutes every day." He described the warning labels as a necessary corrective to counter decades of misinformation from nuclear weapons makers. Remember, this is from the satiric site, The Onion, but the rest of these are for real. In New Orleans comes word that a low-flying helicopter is going to scan the city for possible nuclear weapons. The helicopter, provided by the National Nuclear Security Administration, will fly low over the city seeking to detect radiation. Now, why radiation would be leaking from a fully encapsulated nuclear weapon? I don't know. I don't know that they know, but that's what they're looking for. The officials, in a story that is being swallowed whole by the news media, said that this was, quote, a routine part of security and emergency preparation activities. To which Nuclear Hot Seat replies, what are you talking about? But the most serious of these numbnutseries comes from the U.S. Regulatory Commission, which has approved an updated mission statement that its new chairman, Trump-appointed David Wright, says, should position the agency to be part of the solution. The solution to what? Nuclear dangers? No, no, no. Compare and contrast. The original mission statement for the NRC states that the agency licenses and regulates the nation's civilian use of radioactive materials to provide reasonable assurance of adequate protection of public health and safety, and to promote the common defense and security, and to protect the environment. That's what it did say. What does it say now? The NRC protects public health and safety and advances the nation's common defense and security by enabling the safe and secure use and deployment of civilian nuclear energy technologies and radioactive materials through what they're calling efficient and reliable, I'm emphasizing the important words here, licensing, oversight, and regulation, dig it, for the benefit of society and the environment. In other words, they're taking off the guardrails. They're saying, oh, we no longer protect people and the environment. That's the short version of the old mission statement. They're saying, let's deploy, let's enable, let's help these nukesters by speeding up the licensing process for new nuclear technology, reduce regulatory costs for companies seeking to license, advance, that's the word they're using for these non-existent small modular nuclear reactors, as well as creating a prize to incentivize the successful deployment of next generation reactor technologies. In other words, an already co-opted and captured regulatory agency just got its marching orders, or rather its kneeling and bowing orders, to smooch up to the posterior of the nuclear industry, roll over and do whatever they want. Feeling safer yet? I sure don't. And that is why Nuclear Regulatory Commission, new chairman David Wright, and whoever those idiots are down in New Orleans, all of you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where in Fukushima, at the site of the triple nuclear reactor meltdown following a 9.0 earthquake and tsunami on March 11, 2011, 40% of the workforce there worry about radiation issues on the job, a spike of nearly 3 times more than the previous year. This according to a survey that was distributed by Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, the owners and operators of the site. More than half of those respondents cited fears of their body coming into contact with radioactive substances. TEPCO said recent incidents at the plant probably contributed to the heightened concerns. For example, 2 workers were hospitalized in October 2023 after they were accidentally splashed with waste liquid containing highly radioactive substances while cleaning piping in a contaminated water treatment facility. In another incident, about 1.5 tons of contaminated water flowed out of a water purification facility at the plant through an air exhaust opening. This happened in February of 2024. TEPCO distributed the questionnaire to all workers at the plant and received responses from 5,498 individuals, or a 94.5% response rate. Asked to choose specific issues they were concerned about, 52.2%, the largest percentage, picked physical contamination, up 7 points from 2023. Akira Ono, president of Fukushima Daiichi Decontamination and Decommissioning Engineering Company, said, "Inside buildings, there are some areas with high radiation levels where workers can easily be contaminated. But people can work safely if proper measures are taken." And went on to say, "We want to assuage workers' concerns by communicating this fact." No, Mr. Ono, you can assuage their concerns by making certain that proper safety measures are taken. Always. And we are just now learning how the radioactive fallout from Fukushima that fell on Tokyo was concealed from the public. On March 14 and 15, 2011, 3 days after the Great East Japan earthquake and its resulting tsunami hit the Fukushima nuclear power plant, caused explosions at 2 of the plant's reactor buildings, which released huge amounts of invisible radioactivity. These radioactive plumes were blown away by the wind, descending over the surrounding area and into the ocean. Eventually, the radiation emitted from the Fukushima plants spread out over the entire northern hemisphere. It also spread to Japan's capital, Tokyo. Following the explosions, Japanese researchers rushed to collect and study radioactive materials from the soil and the air to find out what had happened inside the reactors. On March 13, the Tokyo Metropolitan Industrial Technology Research Institute, the agency responsible for measuring the air quality of particulate matter in the Tokyo area, started to collect air samples more frequently. A study of air filters revealed that at about 10 a.m. on March 15, 2011, a large plume of radioactivity reached Tokyo, some 240 kilometers or 149 miles south of Fukushima. All samples taken on March 14 and 15 showed spikes in radioactivity. Japanese radiochemist Satoshi Utsunomiya, an environmental radiochemist from Kyushu University, immediately realized the implications of the findings for public safety. But his study was kept from publication for years. The full story, which is an excellent example of how news about nukes is routinely manipulated by the media and by the institutions we trust to protect us, was recently published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and we will have a link to that article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 710. As for Europe, the head administrator of the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Program, Jill Hruby, seems to have confirmed the transfer of new U.S. nuclear bombs to air bases in Europe. In remarks to the Hudson Institute on January 16, Hruby said, "The new B-6112 gravity bombs are fully forward deployed, and we have increased NATO's visibility to our nuclear capabilities." Hans Christensen of the Federation of American Scientists told Eurasia Times, "This almost sounds like official confirmation that deployment of the B-6112 to Europe has begun." We will link to that article, which is by Nuke Watch's John LaForge. And regarding our recently implemented tariff wars, U.S. nuclear generators used 32 million pounds of imported uranium concentrate, 95% of which originated in other countries, and the largest source of uranium purchased by the U.S. nuclear power plants in 2022, 27% of the total, came from Canada. Oh, Canada. Now here's the ICAN update with Alistair Burnett, head of media for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, reporting from their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICAN in Geneva with the first 2025. The team here has hit the ground running for this very important year for our campaign to eliminate nuclear weapons for good. It is 80 years this year since the invention of nuclear weapons and the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Our message to the leaders of the 9 nuclear-armed states and their pro-nuclear allies, as well as the cheerleaders for nuclear weapons in think tanks and business, is 80 years of living under this existential threat is enough. It is time for them to have the imagination and courage to get rid of their nuclear arsenals. All it takes is political will. There are no practical impediments to dismantling nuclear weapons. All they need to do is give the word. We'll have more on what ICAN is planning for this 80th anniversary year in a minute. We're continuing our preparations for the third meeting of the states' parties to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that takes place at the UN in New York from the 3rd of March to the 7th of March. A report will be presented on how the doctrine of nuclear deterrence, all the nuclear powers follow in some shape or form, is a threat to the security of all countries. On the 28th of January, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday clock the closest it has ever been to midnight, the moment that signifies the end of humanity. They did this because of the increasing threat of nuclear conflict and failure of countries to agree strong enough action on climate change, as well as the failure to effectively regulate the rise of artificial intelligence and other disruptive technologies. Notably, the former Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, who unveiled the clock, used the opportunity to call on all states to join the TPNW. Back to this year's anniversary of the invention and first use of nuclear weapons. I spoke to ICAN's program coordinator, Susie Snyder, who told me why this is such an important year.
80 years is a long time. 80 years is four score, as some people might call it. 80 years is time to forget things like the horrors of nuclear weapons. And so this 80th year, it's really important that we remember what nuclear weapons do. And this 80th year since the invention of nuclear weapons, it's a great time to retire these weapons for good, because we don't like to see things working beyond an 80-year shelf life. 80 years is a number that sticks in our minds, and it's a number that lets us take action and recall that we have something to say and something that we can do about nuclear weapons in this 80th year.
So what is ICAN planning for this year?
Well, the whole year, we've already started talking about this as the 80th year, and it started with our cooperation and our joyous celebration of the Nobel Peace Prize award to Nihon Hidankyo, the Japanese Association of Nuclear Bomb Survivors. They were awarded that prize in December. And we are so excited because 80 years, there's still some of these survivors left who have this firsthand experience. And they are very old. Most of them were children when the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so we can celebrate and share those stories. But not only that, ICAN is also looking to remember all of those whose lives were lost 80 years ago. And one of the things that we're doing is we're launching an online children's memorial, because nuclear weapons do not distinguish between civilians and combatants. Nuclear weapons can't tell that there's a child on a playground, but we can tell their stories and we can remember them. We are also going to activate our hundreds of partners around the world to help share the information about 80 years and to really call out 80 years is enough, because nuclear weapons were unacceptable when they were first invented in July 1945, when they were first exploded. They were unacceptable when they were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945, and they're unacceptable today, 80 years later.
I know what you're going to say in answer to this question, but can this 80-year commemoration, can it move the needle in the nuclear-armed states so that they actually start to engage with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and disarm.
One of the great things about these kind of milestone years is that there's a lot of attention and extra attention paid to them, even in the nuclear armed states. And we recall the past milestone years, these 5-year marks, that have generated more nuclear armed states attendance at the commemorations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki of the bombings. And it also forces more people's attention to it, which then elevates the political attention to these issues, including in nuclear armed states. The issue of nuclear weapons is coming to the fore. There's a new nuclear arms race, and there's a new rise in opposition to that arms race as well. And ICANN's been in the center of this for a while because we continually tell the story of what these weapons do. And it's a story that people in nuclear armed states, especially those who are responsible for their nuclear weapons enterprise, don't want told. So by continuing to tell and to continuing to remind people that these are big, dumb, clumsy bombs, unfit for the world we live in now, we can move the needle, and we are moving the needle in these states. And you can see it already by the way that the leaders of the nuclear armed states are blustering and really running a little bit scared of the conversation around nuclear weapons.
That was Susie Snyder, and this is Alistair Burnett ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, the United Nations meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, is a major event in the world of those of us opposing nuclear, and it is fast upon us. The 73 countries that have signed and ratified the ban, which is international law, along with those countries considering it and others that are observing the process, will come together at the UN for the third meeting of states parties on March 3rd through 7th. I covered the second meeting of states parties for Nuclear Hot Seat in December of 2023 and produced two programs on it, episodes 650 and 651. In them, I presented interviews with diplomats, politicians, and activists from around the world that captured the excitement, optimism, difficulties, hard work, and shared love of life of this international community. My intention is to once again be there to bring you information from international representatives of the movement to rid this planet of nuclear weapons. To that end, I have booked my stay, but I still have to pay for it because it's over and above the regular expenses of running this show. That's where you come in. I'm asking for your help in the form of a donation of any size. It is tax deductible, be this a one-time donation of any amount or as a sustaining member for as little as $5 a month. It's easy to do either way. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that I'm excited to once again be able to bring you information from the front lines of anti-nuclear activism from around the world. So whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that as always, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. The Santa Susana Field Lab in the hills only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles is the site of years of testing of toxic rocket fuel, as well as the site of the 1959 nuclear accident and radiation release that was covered up for 20 years until accidentally discovered by students at UCLA. All these years later, the battle to clean up the site continues, and sometimes we even get to win one. Melissa Bumstead became an accidental activist for the Santa Susana Field Lab cleanup after her 4-year-old daughter was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive form of leukemia in 2014. In her previous life, she was a stay-at-home mom, and before that, a graphic designer. She still lives in West Hills, adjacent to the Santa Susana Field Lab site, with her husband, daughter, who is cancer-free after a life-saving bone marrow transplant in 2017, son, and various pets. She serves as founder and co-director of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab and believes it should be a basic human right to live in an uncontaminated environment. She has fought tirelessly towards that end. I spoke with Melissa Bumstead about the latest developments on Friday, January 31st, 2025. Melissa Bumstead, it's always great having you here on Nuclear Hot Seat, and especially when you've got some good news to share.
Thanks so much for having me.
Fill us in briefly on what the situation has been at the Santa Susana Field Lab and what led up to some news that you initially received on December 30th.
As you probably know, the Santa Susana Field Lab is highly contaminated from both radioactive waste and chemical waste. The thing that's unique about it is that it's up on a hill, and about 700,000 people live down below the site. Most of the radioactive waste is in the form of fallout. It's loose in the soil and in the groundwater. For decades, Boeing, which owns most of the Santa Susana Field Lab, has allowed chemicals in the rain runoff that goes down into the LA River on one side, and on the backside, it goes down into Ventura County's Cayugas Creek. And that watershed in particular is not only used for drinking water, recreation, fragile ecological wildlife, but also for strawberry growing. A lot of the nation's strawberries are grown in Oxnard. That watershed goes all the way through down to the ocean there. So we're looking at a big potential for contamination to spread through the watersheds and through the LA River. Boeing was regulated by a permit from the Water Board, and I won't bore you with all the acronyms, but this permit was getting weaker and weaker and weaker every renewal cycle. And it allowed Boeing to put more and more chemicals and radionuclides into the watersheds without fines. So this last cycle in 2023, Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab, along with several other groups, including Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the Wishtoyo Chumash Foundation, Heal the Bay, LA Water Keepers, and Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, we all started advocating to the Water Board that this was wrong. The water permit needed to be tighter. They needed to be doing groundwater studies. They needed to be doing stronger limitations and using better technology. And for the first time ever, the board listened to us. That was huge. My co-director and I were literally at the podium shaking, actually shaking, giving this presentation to the Water Board. And somehow, I think with all the people calling in, saying how much they have been harmed by the contamination on site and their concerns for water quality, that the board listened to us and they granted a stronger permit. Boeing immediately sued them.
Of course.
Of course. Which means we did it right. That to me is a sign of a darn good job. As soon as they had started the lawsuit, they also pushed for a stay motion so they wouldn't have to actually implement any of the new requirements until the lawsuit had gone through. And the judge said no. It was only just this last year in December, after Boeing pulling all kinds of stall tactics and whatnot, we got the good news that the judge sided with this permit. So the permit, we were so excited, I almost fell out of my chair. The permit is now going to make the Boeing company test with better technology. We've already seen a huge improvement where chemical constituents called PCBs weren't even noticed going into the LA River. We found over 40 hits. PFAS, radionuclides like cesium, strontium-90, all kinds of radionuclides are coming into the LA River, and now they can be tracked. And Boeing is going to be so much more responsible for their pollution getting into the LA River and the Cayugas Creek watershed. So we don't get a lot of victories on our site. This was huge. This was really exciting. And knowing that it's protecting millions of people in Los Angeles from Boeing's irresponsibility at the Santa Susana Field Lab.
First of all, congratulations in letters as big as the Hollywood sign. It's been a long fight to get it this far. Where do you go from here? What's the next step?
We're in a lot of trouble right now because the Department of Energy, which is responsible for the cleanup of the radioactive portion of the Santa Susana Field Lab, they have just announced a notice of intent to break the original cleanup agreements and to start looking at risk-based alternatives that will very likely leave most of their contamination on site. We're wrestling with that. We're trying to get data from them that they're being pretty big gatekeepers. They don't want to show us the statistics and the modeling that they're making all these claims that they can't do a complete background cleanup. It's going to be a big struggle. We've seen this in the works for years now. We knew it was coming. Now here, and now we just have to deal with it.
How are you and the others coping with the ongoing, seemingly never-ending nature of this battle?
Well, our group, we say you can often only either laugh or cry. So if you can, laugh. And one of the ways we're going to do that with this public meeting that Department of Energy is hosting is we're having a no-glow rally. And we're all going to wear glow-in-the-dark material because we're trying to show them we don't want to glow in the dark from all the radioactive waste. So we're going to have a whole crew of people out there protesting wearing, I don't know if I can get anyone to wear slime that glows in the dark, but I probably will because I want to get the point across. This is really dangerous, disgusting radioactive material, glow in the dark material. So for me, that's my sense of humor as a way to combat this, that they can do so many things to us, but they can't take away our right to laugh in their face about it. That's what we're doing.
And it sounds like you also have very strong community support around you.
We're so fortunate. We're so fortunate that people are hearing what's happening. It took a long time for them to believe, but the more the community has been educated and introduced to this, people are really starting to stand up.
And thank you for having been one of those people who worked so hard to educate the public and make them aware. Melissa Bumstead, we'll stay in touch. Let's have Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We will link to their website on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 710. Now, here's what was supposed to be this week's featured interview with veteran peace activist Alice Slater. Only, unfortunately, recording difficulties rendered my beautiful, extensive talk with Alice unusable. Fortunately, we have her words on what we covered from an article she wrote that was sent around by both Code Pink and World Without War. Instead of hearing the information directly from her with her beautiful New York accent, she has given me permission to read it in her stead. I've added a few comments from an email she sent out after the doomsday clock setting was announced so that you have the full benefit of her insights. So you know who I'm quoting. Alice Slater serves on the boards of World Without War and the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. She's an NGO representative to the United Nations for Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. She's a member of the Veterans for Peace Nuclear Abolition Working Group and helped draft the Veterans for Peace Nuclear Posture Review. Her article is called Stop Imagining Doomsday and Start Imagining Peace. It is a reframing of the annual announcement of the Doomsday Clock by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. It reads, "The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, with the advice of Albert Einstein and other scientists from the Manhattan Project who developed the atomic bomb, established a Doomsday Clock in 1947 to illustrate the annihilating danger the Earth has faced since the creation of this diabolical nuclear bomb. At that time, the clock was set at 7 minutes to midnight, their estimate of how much time we had left before nuclear war would wreak catastrophic devastation on our planet and all living things in existence. Shockingly, despite years of nuclear arms control measures, resulting in arsenals down from a high of 70,000 bombs at the peak of the world's nuclear insanity, to about 12,000 bombs today, 11,000 of which are in the U.S. and Russia, with nearly 4,000 poised and ready to go, with another 1,000 held by the other six nuclear weapon states, the U.K., France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. The clock has never been set closer to doomsday than it is today, at 90 seconds to midnight. Again, this was written before the most recent reveal. Alice continues, "It's time to transform the clock and change the conversation. Dire warnings about doomsday have done little to increase our world's safety these 77 years. It's time to speak about the many possibilities and missed opportunities to create the new dawning of a peace day, changing the clock of doom to a clock that can tick off the many solutions that have been ignored and disregarded. We must stop giving our blessing and consent to the endless steps to control arms that lead to ever more danger, as illustrated by the aging doomsday clock. Instead, we must demand their abolition as we move to a nuclear-free world at peace, unthreatened by catastrophic annihilation. Indeed, scholars writing of the sad story of endless negotiations to control arms, but never to abolish them, have even coined a new term for the meaningless steps to nowhere, antipreneurism, where instead of the U.S. proposing abolition, or total and complete disarmament, or elimination of weapons, it is always proposing new meaningless steps towards illusory progress. To begin a new conversation for abolition, we must acknowledge the missed opportunities and broken promises since the dawn of the atomic age. At the very beginning, in 1945, Stalin asked Truman to put the nuclear bomb under international control at the newly established United Nations. The U.S. rejected Russia's proposal, and Russia got the bomb. When the wall came down in Germany and Gorbachev dissolved the Warsaw Pact and freed all of occupied Eastern Europe, he proposed to Reagan that the U.S. and Russia eliminate all our nuclear weapons, provided the U.S. would end its Star Wars program to dominate and control the military use of space. Reagan turned him down, and Gorbachev withdrew Russia's offer. Gorbachev, anxious about the fate of East Germany, urged Reagan not to take a united Germany into NATO. The Russians lost 27 million people to the Nazi onslaught of World War II. The U.S. assured him that NATO would not expand one inch east. But despite repeated requests to the U.S. from Russian President Putin to honor those U.S. promises made to Gorbachev and again to Yeltsin, the U.S., driven by visions of empire, steadily expanded NATO eastward. It began with Clinton's expansion of NATO to Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic in 1999, followed by Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia in 2004, and Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia between 2009 and 2017. And during the war in Ukraine, Sweden and Finland joined NATO. The U.S. stations nuclear weapons in five states: Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, Belgium, and Turkey. Russia, during the Ukraine war, put nuclear weapons in Belarus. Clinton led NATO in the bombing of Kosovo in 1999, bypassing Russia's veto in the Security Council, violating the UN treaty we signed never to commit a war of aggression against another nation unless under imminent threat of attack. Clinton also refused Putin's offer to each cut our massive nuclear arsenals to 1,000 bombs each and call all the others to the table to negotiate for their elimination, provided we stopped developing missile sites in Romania. Bush walked out of the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2002, and Obama put the new missile base in Romania while Trump built another in Poland. Obama pledged over $1 trillion for the next 30 years for two new nuclear bomb factories, missiles, submarines, airplanes, and warheads, which was upped even more by Trump and Biden. Despite repeated requests from Russia and China to negotiate treaties to ban weapons in space and cyber war in UN resolutions and negotiating forums, the U.S. refuses to cooperate. We are at a turning point in history. It is time to change the conversation with bold new proposals. Proposals that are guaranteed to bring us a respite from the growing terror. Proposals that will bring a shift in planetary consciousness, allowing us to respond cooperatively to the impending cataclysmic climate disaster down the road. Proposals that will usher in a rising dawn and change the doomsday clock into a new peace clock. Mother Earth grows impatient with the folly of humankind. Here are a series of steps that are most likely to lead to peace on Earth if the U.S. is ready to mobilize against what has been described as the Mickeymat, the military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academic think tank complex, and work for peace. First, take up repeated Russian and Chinese proposals for treaties to ban weapons in space and cyber war. 2. Reinstate the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia and remove U.S. missiles from Romania and Poland. 3. Remove U.S. nuclear weapons from 5 NATO states in a deal for Russia removing its recently placed nuclear weapons in Belarus. 4. Take all nuclear weapons off high alert and separate the warheads from their delivery systems as China does. That is the wisdom of the East. 5. Dismantle NATO and respect and honor the United Nations. There is little doubt that Russia and China would be willing partners in these initiatives. They have been proposing them to the United States and voting on them in the UN for more than 10 years. This is the article by Alice Slater, as published by World Beyond War and Code Pink. After this year's Doomsday Clock unveiling, showing that it had moved 1 second closer to midnight, meaning 89 seconds to midnight, Alice posted the following in an email as a footnote. The threat of the bomb does not bring peace. It allows the greatest horrors mankind has ever witnessed. Our fear? Nuclear weapons in the hands of madmen. It has happened. We must act now. Alice Slater. We will have a link up to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 710. Those were the words and insights of Alice Slater. We will link to the full article, Stop Imagining Doomsday and Start Imagining Peace, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 710.
Activist shout out.
As you can tell from the announcements I've been making here on Nuclear Hot Seat, the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is taking place at the UN headquarters only a few short weeks from now. But you may be asking yourself, what is a meeting of states parties? Why is it taking place at the UN? And what are we doing when we get there? To find out more, there are two webinars coming up to fill you in and help with your understanding. The first is A Newcomer's Guide to the TPNW 3MSP, Third Meeting of States Parties. It's a Zoom call which will take place on Tuesday, February 11, at either 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, which translates into, the easiest being from the 8 p.m. call, 3 p.m. Eastern or noon Pacific time here in the United States. And Mayors for Peace is extending an invitation for you to join an international peace education webinar to promote youth-led peace activities in member cities and beyond. This will take place on Tuesday, February 18, between 7 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, which translates into 2 a.m. in New York, or 11 p.m. or 11 p.m. on February 17 in Los Angeles. In that case, it's probably going to be best if you listen to a replay if you're here in the United States. It will feature young people engaged in peace activities across many different countries, those who will lead the next generation, and they'll share their experiences and exchange ideas. It's always good to have that infusion of hope. I'll have links up to both of these calls on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 710. And giving you a little bit more lead time, on Monday, March 24th, at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, there's going to be a webinar on A New Generation of Nuclear Lies, Small Modular Reactors, and Nuclear Plant Reopenings. The featured speakers will be Paul Gunter, Energy Policy Analyst and Spokesperson at Beyond Nuclear, and M. V. Ramana, Simmons Chair in Disarmament and Professor at the University of British Columbia. The event will be moderated by Linda Pence Gunter, who's both an international specialist at Beyond Nuclear and a regular commentator here on Nuclear Hot Seat with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. You must register to attend, and that information will also be on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 710. And a reminder that my nuclear-themed play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due, is still looking for possible reading opportunities with theater companies, organized activist groups, or anyone who might be interested. The play is an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. It both asks and answers the question, how do you hide an atom bomb blast in plain sight? The story is centered on events around the Trinity bomb test in New Mexico on July 16, 1945, and would be an excellent addition to any events you're currently planning around this being the 80th anniversary of the start of the nuclear nightmare age. If you have any interest or know any theater company or theater people who would be interested, shoot me an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com and I'll be happy to discuss it further. For now, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 4, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way for you to guarantee that you don't miss a single episode. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, of course, but help me out with my algorithm, would you please? Do it through my website. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big honking yellow box that pops up that you really can't avoid that asks for your first name and your email address. Fill that in, and every week you will get one, just one, email from Nuclear Hot Seat with a link to that week's episode and a brief description of what some of the information inside it will be. Easy peasy. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. You see the stories close up that are in your area. I need your help to be able to identify them and who I need to talk to get all the details. So help me continue to make Nuclear Hot Seat as thorough and complete as I can in covering the issues about nuclear that are most important to you. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Right now, it's all going to help me get to New York to cover the Treaty on the Prohibition on Nuclear Weapons meetings at the United Nations. So do what you can, and know that I really and always am deeply grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, every nuclear reactor creates deadly radioactive waste that lasts forever. So for any program to fight climate change to be genuinely green, it must not include nuclear. There you have it. Your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.